Thank you.
Thank you very much, Don. And I love that girl. Isn't that nice? you do something down here that I always rather liked, and so I mustn't forget to try and do it down here since I'm here. And that is, my name is Eve. I'm going to say Marsh because that's what it is. Okay, all right, okay. And by the grace of God and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had the need to take a drink or any kind of pill or medication or anything since January 6, 1945. Very close to it. Thank you, Homer. Okay. I want to thank the committee for asking me to come out here. I love Texas. I haven't been too many places in Texas, and Midland's one of the places I've missed. And I have friends here that I've met hither and yon. I want to thank Joe for calling me up a couple of times to keep reassuring me that I was still invited. And Irene for the lovely letters she sent me, kept imploring me to let her know when I was coming. Unfortunately, because of the fact that I am working 4 days a week, I couldn't get here until late last night. And I was very disappointed that I had to miss Clancy. But the AA fellowship being what it is, I find that Clancy's and my paths will cross again in the not-too-distant future, and then I will be there. But as I got here late last night, Don met me at the airport, my old friend, and Joe, and we came up into the elevator and came up into the second floor here, and all of a sudden, there was that wonderful bubble, that wonderful enthusiasm, that wonderful noise, that joyousness. And I knew I was home. I came into this room and sensed that wonderful feeling of love. Because that's what this fellowship is all about, I do believe. This wonderful sharing, this wonderful caring, this wonderful ability to get out of ourselves for the first time perhaps in our lives, and to get the feeling that we love people and that people can love us. Clancy said, I guess, he was quoted enough times last night in the after meeting, so I practically don't have to hear his talk, but evidently he said something about loving AA. And I think I fell in love with AA when I first came in, and I've never changed that. It's been a constantly, marvelously growing love and maturing love. And I think sometimes we have to remember that most of us feel that way about AA. Most of us have that sense of love about the fellowship. And I think sometimes when we hear people who we feel are perhaps wearing blinders, who are perhaps overly conservative in these days of growing alcoholism programs and so on and so forth, when we hear people who are rather rigid in their concepts about Alcoholics Anonymous, that we must remember that the reason they feel that way is because they are being protective. Because they want to protect this fellowship that gave us life, that gave us love. And they want not to have anything happen to it. And there's a kind of fear that perhaps all this tremendous excitement and growth about alcoholism programs away from AA may in some way endanger our fellowship. And it's because of their love for the fellowship, perhaps, that they have these feelings. And so I try and remember that when somebody doesn't agree with me. I just kind of figure, well, They feel that way because they feel as I do. They love AA. And I love AA so much that I want everybody to have an opportunity to receive it. And I don't care where they get it or how they get it, as long as they get it. You know, there are so many paradoxes, if you will, in this wonderful fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hesitated for a minute about saying my name is Eve Marsh, because I know there are people who feel very strongly about anonymity. And God knows I feel strongly about it from the point of view of the public. I would never want my name printed in the newspaper as member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I believe deeply in the spiritual value of the tradition. And I'm not important because I'm in AA. But my sobriety is important. And it's an example of that sobriety is something that can lead somebody else to this fellowship. I want it known. I want it known. I remember when I first moved to Florida, I met some lovely girls who began to play bridge in the afternoon. That was the first retirement, and I wasn't going to work. But I was playing bridge the afternoon for a while. But anyhow, this lovely girl came over, and evidently she had lived in the same building that I had now moved into. And she came in, and I'd gotten pretty acid, and she got in, came in my room, she said, "My goodness, does anybody in this building know you're in AA?" And I said, "Probably everybody." "Oh, God, I don't want anybody to know that I'm in AA." I said, "For heaven's sake, sweetheart, I could have met you any place. I could have met you at the Women's Club, I could have met you at the Symphony, I could have, oh, I don't know, they know I didn't go there." You know, and she was so worried. But you know, to this day, I'm still working on one gal in that room, in that apartment building, who knows I'm in AA and who every now and then seeks me out as she struggles in her loneliness to find an answer to her problem. How can we be the example if people don't know what we are? And so anonymity... anonymity is something I think that we need to understand in its context of what its real purpose is, that we're not wonderful because we're in AA. AA is wonderful. And so that business of being an example and of sharing this experience and of being able to let people see that light that shines within, because that's what we find that wonderful light within when we come into this fellowship and are able to make that tremendous slow growth that we do as we begin to try and work in the AA program. As I talk along, you'll think, my goodness, maybe she knew all these things back then. I didn't know anything back then. Everything that I share with you today is the result of years in AA and of trying one day at a time to make this program more vital, more alive, to get a better understanding of myself and of what AA is trying to teach me. The things that I've learned about myself are things that I have learned through AA, things that I did not know at the time. If we knew all these things about ourselves when we were drinking, perhaps maybe we might not have needed to drink. You know, that's one of the interesting things about AA, I think. When we come to a fellowship and we start taking that marvelous fourth step, we begin to know ourselves in a way that most people never have an opportunity to know themselves. That fourth step, which is so exciting and such a challenge, that we find to become aware of who we are and what we are. And so we learn these things about ourselves. And I'm so grateful that when I came to AA, they said to me, "Don't worry about why you got to be an alcoholic. The important thing is to accept the fact that you are one and to do what you can to recover and to try and walk the AA path." But nonetheless, as we do go along in AA, as we do begin to work with this fourth step and the fifth step, and as we begin to know ourselves, we can't help but look back and say, "Aha, I do see how this contributed to the problems I had with myself and with my drinking." And I think that's the interesting thing about AA, because that's the difference in focus. And then when you come right down to it, that's what it is. It's a difference in focus. In Alcoholics Anonymous, they tell us, "I am an alcoholic. I can never safely drink." And we go on in the program, and we work the fourth step, and we find out about ourselves, and we begin to recognize these things that were things that needed to be changed. Because that's what we have to do. We have to change. We can't stay the same person we were when we walked in that door, or we're going to drink again. And so we make these changes, and we can recognize these things in ourselves. But we make them in the frame of reference that I am an alcoholic, and I can never safely drink. And that's our focus. In psychiatry, they say, "Aha, let's find out why you drink." But the focus isn't there. And too often that marvelous little mind of ours says, "Aha, if I can find out the why, then I can drink." The church. So many wonderful people have tried to help us in our years of agony. The church used to say, "Come to church, find God, and you'll find sobriety." AA says, "Find sobriety, and you'll find your higher power." It's a difference in focus. But as I said, I didn't know any of these things when I first came to the fellowship. When I walked in the ward door of AA, I was so full of fear, I was so frightened of people and of course of myself. I was terrified of trying to communicate in any way at all. And I had no idea when I walked in that door what I was going to find here. I knew instantly that there was something here I wanted. I knew instantly that there was a love and an understanding that I had never gotten anyplace else. And I knew somehow that this was my answer, but I didn't know how it was going to change my life. I didn't recognize these things of which I've just been speaking. I didn't recognize that I was going to have to make these changes in me. Like so many of us, I thought that if I just stopped drinking, that was all I needed to do. If that's all I needed to do, I wouldn't have had the joy of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the joy is in the turn. The joy is in the growing. The joy is in learning to love. The joy is in all these marvelous dividends that come to us through the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous based on that bedrock of sobriety. And sobriety is based on growing and on changing and on learning our place in this spectrum, in this world that we live in. Knowing our spot in the universe. But as I said, I didn't know any of those things. And I was full of fear. I had always been full of fear. I had always felt unwanted and unloved and had a terrible sense of lack. That feeling of lack, it was a lack in me, I'm sure. But nonetheless, I always had that sense of lack. It seemed to me that other people always had more than I had. And it was true enough that my father, during the years that I was going to school as a girl, was going through a difficult time. He was a playwright and an author, and authors' incomes go up and down. And during that down period, we'd moved back into the city of New York. My mother had died, and my father was trying to raise three daughters. He didn't really understand much about girls, but he was doing the best he knew how. And he felt that it was important that we all go to private schools. In the city of New York, we do go to private schools. And so we went to this lovely, lovely private school, but the trouble with that was that everybody had more than I had. Dad got us to the school. But we didn't have the butlers, and we didn't have the maids, and we didn't have the upstairs girls, and we didn't have the cars, and we didn't have the pretty dresses, and we didn't have the things that the other girls had. And it made me feel inferior. I thought that's what made me feel inferior. I've learned through AA that the feelings of inferior were my problems. Inferiority were my problems. They were the feelings that I had, and that I had for such a very long time. But that sense of lack and inferiority and of unlovability was with me from the very start. And I wasn't very lovable. You know, I was a homely, awkward, unbelievably difficult human being during those growing teen years. I was as tall as I am now, and my dad wouldn't let me cut my hair. This is back during flaming youth, I hate to tell you. And the hair had to be all short. You know, everybody had short hair, but I wasn't allowed to have short hair. Well, then I thought I'd put it up. Oh, no, you're only 14. You're too young to put it up. So I would go to school with all these very sophisticated, flaming youth babies, and I had a braid down my back, and I had skipped grades because, like so many of us, I was, you know, smart. Smart, smart. You know, marvelous. Get great grades, not remember things in the test the next day. But the result was they kept skipping me. So I was in grades higher than myself, age level higher than I was. And yet I had this terrible feeling that I was, you know, so homely, awkward, all elbows and knees and nose. Oh, my God, my nose. No, I never broke it. I think there are a few people who would have liked to break it over the years, but I never broke it. And so I had these terrible feelings of inferiority and being unloved and uncared for. And I had two sisters, and they were both beautiful. And it all just seemed to add together and make me feel like an empty, empty human being. And then finally my father decided that it was time for me to go to college, and he sent me off to Vassar. My mother had gone to Vassar. Kind of a family tradition. My sisters were going to go to Vassar after me. And I went off to Vassar, and I was just 16 years old. And I had absolutely no ability to communicate with people. I had none of the social graces. We hadn't belonged to the clubs in Brooklyn. I didn't know how to dance. I'd never been kissed. Girl. You know, you can see that I was an absolute mess.
And so I got up to college, and here were all these lovely, charming certificates, and they had dates with them and all the rest of it. And my father had taken me up there. We went to chapel, and I wept. And I cried, and I wept, and I said, "Dad, please don't leave me here. Please don't leave me here. I cannot stay." And he used his favorite line with me, which always made me miserable. He said, "You're daddy's big girl. You can handle it." And I was. I was so big. You know, they grow these long-stemmed American beauties much taller these days than they did back in the 1800s, about which I'm speaking. In any event, he left me, and I went up to my back to my room. I had been in my room. I'd met my roommate. She seemed a very attractive, nice gal. So I went back up there full of tears and self-pity. Oh, that was one of my favorite employments, self-pity. I went back up there, and I found a note. My roommate had requested a transfer, and I was being assigned a new one. I've never felt such a terrible sense of rejection in my life, and my new roommate arrived. And there began one of the things that I didn't understand that was to dog me through my days of alcoholism, through my drinking, and for a long time into my sobriety. And here again, the importance of getting to know ourselves and understand ourselves. Because there I was, full of rejection and feelings of inferiority, because this woman had asked, gal had asked for a transfer. And yet here comes this new roommate, a nice, mousy little gal, the kind we used to call crusties in those days, because she studied a lot and had greasy hair, you know. And I looked at her, and I thought to myself, on top of this terrible feeling of rejection and inferiority, I deserve better than this. This terrible mixture of inferiority and superiority, this awful feeling of rejection coupled with arrogance. And I didn't understand myself. And it took me years in AA and work on the fourth step to try to finally understand that these are the two sides of the coin of ego. And that we have to get rid of that dross and get down to that good, solid gold, that fine pureness, which is within, which we have to have a good self-image, to be able to love ourselves. Thank God they told me I had to love myself when I came to AA. Because I didn't know that if I didn't love myself, I couldn't love you. And oh, how much I've loved loving you. And I couldn't have had that gift if it hadn't been for the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I went on my way in college, and of course it was back during the Prohibition years. Now, I didn't drink. I made up my mind I wasn't going to drink. Everybody else drank the old hip flask routine. I was so totally unattractive anyway, I'm sure that the not drinking didn't have much to do with it. But I never did get to football games and fraternity dances that first couple of years at college. Because I was just a mess, in one word. But anyway, I knew that my father was going to send me to Europe. That lovely gal who was talking last night, there were so many things she said that reminded me so much of things in my own early life. And so I knew that I was going to go off to Europe because in those days, every father of any worth who could beg, borrow, or steal the money made sure that his daughters went on the grand tour. And so as ex-chaperones and all the rest of it, there were 14 or 15 of us, we went merrily on our way to Europe to get culture with a capital K. And of course I didn't drink, but I had made up my mind that when I got to Europe, that's where I would start, because that's where I would learn to drink graciously as Europeans drank. A little wine with my meals. I had the charming picture of the gracious lady with a little bit of wine with my dinner, and I thought in that way I would avoid this business of drinking as Prohibition people drank. I didn't wait till I got to Europe. 12 miles out, they began to serve. I didn't know what to order. Someone next to me ordered an orange blossom. Yes. So I ordered an orange blossom. It isn't just the breakfast anymore. But you know, the most marvelous thing happened. I sipped at that little cocktail, that orange blossom,
and wonderful things began to happen to me. In the first place, I shrank. All kidding aside, it was the most marvelous sensation. Well, why should I tell you? You know. It was that wonderful, I don't know, did you say something about boom, boom? I don't have to hear you, Clancy. But it was that marvelous feeling of, I'm whole. I'm a human being. I can talk. I'm attractive. I'm pretty. I got eyes as blue and 5 foot two, you know. And so right then and there, I had found the coping medicine. What was to be my coping medicine until I came to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why I believe I was an alcoholic from the time I had my first drink. Because alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Did for me what I didn't have any faith for a higher power to do. Did for me, I suppose, what it's done for man since time immemorial. And so, I was an alcoholic and didn't know it. That's a sad thing, that people don't know it. I sometimes despair when I think of the years we've spent working to try and explain alcoholism, to try and show people what alcoholism is, that it starts young, that we end up by treating it in its final stages, that it's there when they start. And why can't we help people to recognize that fact? Why can't we let them see that this is the beginning? In every other illness known to man, we could talk about early detection. We talk about detect it early and treat it early, and then it's not going to get so bad. We do it for everything except alcoholism. And for alcoholism, we say it doesn't exist. We deny it. The government spends hundreds of thousands of dollars for something called the RAND report to prove that there isn't any such thing as alcoholism. And yet we know it is. We know that it starts with us from within. And that we have to cope with it from within. And that's what the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. But of course I didn't know any of this. I just thought I'd found the answers to my problems. And I didn't see as much of Europe as I might have seen otherwise. I can remember Zelly's Bar in Paris, drinking warm champagne. I was with a young man that I was terribly anxious to impress. I had bought a coat in Rome that was black with leopard trim, and I thought it was just too big, as it was just marvelous. And I had this guy, and I was going to impress him. I did. I threw up warm champagne. Oh. So from the beginning, I had great hopes of what alcohol would do for me. But in the very beginning, it began to let me down. But I went back to college, and I no longer was the wallflower. I began to go to some of the football games and the fraternity dances. And I discovered that there was a speakeasy not far away, now it was far off the campus. And a very interesting thing, the speakeasy was run by the superintendent of the main hall, which is the big dormitory for freshmen. He was a very obliging fellow. He used to drive us over in his car so we could get there. And eventually the roof fell in. The speakeasy was discovered. And we had that wonderful thing called honor system at Vassar. You know, you tell on your friends and we'll let you go. That was the way it worked. Somebody told on me. All of a sudden I'm arrested and taken to Metcalf, which is the infirmary, which was the place where you were imprisoned if you were under suspension or something. And they all came to me, the student council and all, and they said, if you'll give us the names of everybody you know who's had a drink on campus and who's smoked in their rooms, we'll let you walk. I said, I can't do it. I'm sorry. And so I was expelled. And I felt terrible. I felt terrible. My father came up to get me. And right there started one of those other things that happens to us as we go along. I'm dying inside. I'm crying. I'm hurt. And I want to tell my father, oh, Dad, I'm so sorry. I know how much you wanted me to be here. I know how much it meant to you to have me go to Baptist. Forgive me. Did I say those things? No. I said, oh, thank God. You know, Dad, if they hadn't kicked me out, I would have left. Really, it's a terrible place. I just hardly could stand it. All that cover-up, all that hiding, how they really feel, all that pretense. And that was the beginning of the way I began to live the rest of my life until I came to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went on and did a lot of crazy things with my life. Who was it last night that they started getting married? I did too. One of the lads last night, I guess it was the last speaker, Jim. I started out getting married, but I started out first to do something else which I thought was terribly important. I wanted to be in the theater. My uncle was an actor, my father was a playwright, and I had been brought up amongst people of the theater. And I differentiate the theater, you know, from musical comedy because they were two totally different worlds and a great snobbery between the two. But be that as it may, I got a job, and I did get in the theater. My uncle gave me a job. I didn't have to look for anything. It was handed to me on a silver platter. And I began to do all the things that alcoholics do. I began to resent the fact I wasn't getting bigger parts. I began to resent the fact that I got less pay than anybody else. You know, he had to prove he wasn't going to do me any favors. And so he paid me $12 a week, and all the other extras got $20. And that was to let me know that I wasn't to expect anything special because he was my uncle. And the same thing was true for the part. And the drinking continued. And the drinking continued. And I finally just didn't go on with him. He finally said to me, no, I haven't any parts that are big enough for you. And I was happy to take that as an excuse. So I'm not staying with him. I understood. And then I went on and did a lot of other things. But you know, it's only been since I've been in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've been able to look back at that and see it for what it was. I wanted to be an actor. Did I? Did I really want to go through all the work and the hard effort that it requires to really be a fine craftsman at my profession? Did I want to study? Did I want to be able to breathe properly and project to the last row in the balcony? We didn't have these things then. We learned to have to project to the last row in the balcony. Did I want to take dancing lessons for my poise and my grace to be there? Did I want to do all the hard work that was required to really be a fine actress? And you know, when you get down to the bottom line, I didn't. What did I want? I wanted to be a star. I wanted my name in light. I wanted people to rush up to me after the theater and say, oh, you're so wonderful. Can I have your autograph? I wanted to have people think I was wonderful. And you know, I've come in AA to recognize the fact that that's because I had that feeling that if they thought I was wonderful, maybe I'd think I was. So we all of us have that terrible need for perfection, to prove to other people how great we are, so we can have that sense of self-worth inside ourselves, because we don't have it. When you've talked to people, have you ever been to anybody who said, yes, my goal was to be the second best secretary, the second best teacher, the second best lecturer, the second best businessman? No. We always wanted to get to be the best, because we were proving something. At least I was. But there again is something I didn't recognize. And so I got into AA, and I began to work on this marvelous fourth step. I began to get aware of who I was, and what I was, and what I needed to do to make changes in me. Because of that, I know I had to do. But I'm a long way from finding AA at this point. I started in getting married. I started in having children. Then I got married again. Oh, that marriage didn't last, so I got married again. And this time I was a little bit more careful on who I married. I married a guy who drank the same way I did. I thought that would solve everything. I was so sick of being criticized for my drinking. And I'm talking now about the time when I was 23, 24 years old. I already had a son, and, you know, I was divorced, and I'd go out on dates, and everybody said, oh, you get drunk too much. You know, it got to be a bore. So when I found this marvelous guy who not only drank the same way I did, but who taught me that the morning drink would solve my problem, you know, I thought I had a solution, so I married him. It was the answer, I thought, I was sure.
And of course, the sad part about that was we were two alcoholics, neither one of us knowing we had a problem. Neither one of us recognizing the fact that we did suffer from the illness of alcoholism. Who knew about alcoholism? Nobody knew about alcoholism in those days. It wasn't talked about. I'll never forget once when my husband and I had been on a terrible drunk. The two little girls, how they ever took care of themselves, I'll never know. My son, he was quite a lot older than they, because he was 10 years older than my daughter and 13 years older than the other one, the younger one. He used to look after me. You know, I have to remember that, but I know I don't have as much love for him as I wish I did today, if he's the one I hurt. But that particular morning, my mother-in-law was due to come and see us. And she arrived at 11 o'clock in the morning, and we were both in bed with hangovers. He was supposed to go to work in the family business, and he wasn't there. She stayed for a day. She was very unhappy about it. I was miserable. I felt guilty. I always felt guilty. My husband never did. He'd drink a shot of whiskey in the morning while I was draped over the toilet bowl trying to get myself together. And he said, God, if I felt like that, I'd stop drinking. It's very sad in a way, because he never did feel like that, and he never did stop drinking. It's too bad, because that was his image of what an alcoholic had to be, somebody draped over a toilet bowl, vomiting in the morning. And he never got that. He had other things. And so he never found the air. But that morning, my mother-in-law finally left. And she left a little note attached to the refrigerator. I'll never forget it. It said, my dear children, the world frowns upon inebriates. 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 Some of you don't like the word alcoholic. Try inebriate on for some. But I bless her, because she said, there is an answer. I am writing to Alcoholics Anonymous and asking them to send you some material. Now, I vaguely knew that there was something terribly wrong, but I thought it was with Roger. Nothing wrong with me. I'm perfect. You know, but there's something wrong with Roger. And I had read the Saturday Evening Post article in 1941, the March 1st issue, and it was called Freed Slaves of Drink. We sometimes don't remember that title because we just talk about it as a Saturday Evening Post reprint. But that was the title, and it was all across the front page, the center page. Free Slaves of Drink. And I read this thing, and I saw this man lying down in the gutter. I didn't know it was Johnny S. from the Vermont Burlington Group, Burlington, Vermont Group, who posed for it at the time. But in any event, there was an answer there. And I thought to myself, this is wonderful. If Roger will join this, then he'll stop drinking and I won't have to drink. I really thought he was my problem. And if that isn't the pattern that we all have, everything else is the problem. It's never us. It's never the drink. It's always something outside ourselves. This is one of the wonderful things AA teaches us, that there isn't anything outside ourselves that we have to be responsible for ourselves. And I didn't know that. And so I blamed Roger, because I couldn't afford to stop drinking. It was my life. How did one live without life? And that was the way I could live. But I thought that if he stopped drinking, I wouldn't drink so much, because he was the problem. And so I had that much knowledge about AA. And so when my mother-in-law had the pamphlets sent to me, and I read them, and there was a pamphlet in those early days, there was only one, really. And it had several stories in it, and one of them was a woman. And when I read this woman's story and realized that there were women like me, that there was a possibility that I could get well, a little hope was born. But I was too frightened. I was too desperately alone. I was too full of fear and shame and guilt. The guilt that I lived with was unbelievable. Those two beautiful little girls that we had together, my son, I used to feel so guilty for the things that I used to do. To this day, I can see my youngest sitting in a little canvas swing which hung in an archway between the living room and the dining room in this big old apartment that looked out over Riverside Drive.
and I would stick her in there because I knew she was safe. I hate to tell you how many hours that little one spent in that little canvas wing. And I would pass out after lunch. My older one, who was about 3, would run all around, and the little one would be in the canvas wing. And why they weren't hurt, I know now, the grace of God. So I had these terrible feelings of guilt and remorse and shame. I didn't understand that alcoholism was an illness. I thought there was something terribly wrong with me. I thought there was a moral issue involved here. And there was, in the sense that I did things drinking that I would never have done sober. And so when I read this literature, I thought there was an answer. But I thought that if I just read the literature, I could do it on my own. I didn't know how much I needed you. Eventually, I couldn't stop. And I walked into that old 24th Street clubhouse and had that wonderful awakening of here is love, here is understanding, here I will find answers. But as I said, I didn't recognize the fact that I was going to have to change. I was very slow in AA. I found it very difficult because I was so self-involved. I was so, you know, they say we're selfish. I don't like that word. I don't think we're basically selfish. I think we're so self-involved. Everything was pertaining to me. Everything as it related to me. You know, I used to worry so. I can't go to the meeting tonight. I haven't got a nice dress to wear. What will they think of me? You know? And years later, a little incident happened which rather exemplifies that, I think. I was going off on a conference speaking somewhere, and it was in the days of the big hat. And I used to wear a great big cartwheel hat. It was very becoming. And I was packing my suitcase, and my 2 little girls were sitting alongside of me at the dressing table watching me get ready to go. And I'm getting my face on and combing my hair, and they're leaning over and chatting and all the rest of it. And finally I said, you know, I really can't decide whether I should take the big hat, which is hard to pack, or that little tiny one. And I went on stewing about the big hat or the little hat until finding my youngest, who to this day has more sense than her mother, put her hands on her skinny little hips and said, Mommy, I thought the important thing was what you said, not what you wore. I've been staying with her this last couple of weeks because I rented my apartment for a month. And I began to be a little concerned that I didn't have the right things to come down here. And I remembered what she said. The important thing is what I say, not what I wear. So I didn't know that I had to make all these changes in me. I didn't know that I had to grow. I didn't know that I had to learn by using these steps of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous how to become the kind of person I had always wanted to be, but didn't know how. They used to say things to me like, let go and let God. I said, oh, what does that mean? What are they talking about, you know? What does that mean? Because, you see, the first step was so wonderful and so easy. I knew I was an alcoholic. I never could understand those people who were ashamed to say they were an alcoholic, who would pass out in the supermarket, you know? So it was easy to say my life was unmanageable because God knows it was, and I knew I was an alcoholic. And the second step came to believe. Oh, how I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, and that power was you. Because it was in you I saw that power. I saw the example of people staying sober, and I knew I could, if you could. A little touch of arrogance in that, too, I have to confess as I look back. I used to look at some of the people in the meetings and say, oh my, if they can stay sober, surely I can. But I have learned not to be so arrogant because I have seen some of the brightest people unable to find a handle on to AA. And some of the simplest, lovingest, dearest people who've been sober from the day they first walked in the door. The third step threw me. My ego was so strong that I could not turn my will and my life over to the care of something unknown to me. And so I had to begin a search. Thank goodness they said to me, don't stop. Go on with the program. But keep coming back to the third step. But don't stop here. I'm glad they told me that. I know some people say you must take them in order, but I think the wonderful thing about AA is that this is an individual program, and that each one of us does it in a way which is going to help us. And so I began to search. I began to read. I began to study. I began to try and find out. And that 11th step to me was really an answer, because I really sought through prayer and meditation not so much to improve my conscious contact, but to establish a conscious contact. And that 11th step to me was a wonderful thing, because I didn't know how to pray. You know, I was brought up in the old tradition that you had to get down on your knees and pray. And I'm so self-conscious about my awkwardness and all the rest of it. You know, you'd have thought that there was an audience watching me kneel down beside the bed. But the important thing was that I was not comfortable on my knees beside my bed. And it was the most wonderful thing in the world when I read somewhere that it didn't make any difference what position you were in when you prayed. If you could pray anywhere, at any time, lying down, standing up, kneeling, swimming. I pray every morning in my swimming pool. It's the most wonderful place to pray. It's like a baptism. I love praying in my swimming pool in the morning. Mine and 16 other people in the apartment. That's great. And so I use the 11th step as a prayer. And I'll never forget one day I was terrified of riding in the subways, absolutely terrified of riding in the subway. There's awful claustrophobia in the crowds, and it was burning me, and I didn't think I could bear it. And I had to go down, I had to go to Wall Street, and there was absolutely no way to get there except by subway. And so I got in that subway, and panic began to come on. Panic. You know that horrible feeling of panic. And that began to come in, and I stood there. And I said to myself, thought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand Him. And I kept repeating the 11 steps, and the panic left me, and I was able to ride subways from then on. So I knew that prayer worked. And I finally found the God of my understanding and was able to go back to the third step. And I remembered that they said you only have to do everything one day at a time. I don't know how Mike ever stayed sober, thinking he had to stay sober for the rest of his life, because to me that business of one day at a time was so terribly important. I knew that I could live through this day of agony and tomorrow will be another day. And of course I think that daily living is the quintessence of the program today, because you can stand anything for one day and tomorrow's another day. And tomorrow's a challenge. And every day can be different, and every day can be exciting. Because that's what living is excitement and enthusiasm. And the ability to enjoy living. That's what AA has given me, the ability to enjoy living. Got off on that, now I've lost my 24 hours at a time, right? I only had to turn my will and my life over one day at a time. And so I began tentatively to do that. Every now and then I'd take it back, you know. Take it back and have it my own for a couple of days. And then it was amazing how things went wrong. It was amazing how things went wrong. So I turned it over again. And I finally learned that those are the moments of really ultimate joy and happiness. That sense of being that oneness, that being at one with this power, whatever it is for each one of us. And so I began very slowly to grow in the AA program. A lot of work to be done. Still a lot of work to be done. That, to me, is one of the exciting things about it. You know, that we never graduate. You know, on one of these peregrinations that Don was talking about, I had an opportunity. Oh, this, I'm so far past now. I'm way up. Time has flown by. I'll get back. But I love this little experience that I had in Japan once. And I got to Japan, and I wanted to go to the meeting. And they told me it was at 5 o'clock at St. Albans Church. And so I was in a Japanese hotel, and they wrote out the name of the church with the taxi driver and the name of the hotel, because they don't read English the way we, you know, letters the way we do, and you have to have it all in their script. And it was dark, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, November, Japan.
pitch dark. So we go careening through the streets of Tokyo, and he drops me off in front of this great big church. And then he's gone. And there I am, and the church looks dark, and it looks strange, and that there was nobody there, and it's sort of falling down here in the front. These big blocks of marble are sort of falling apart. So I scramble up, and I go on around, and there's nobody. I can't see a soul. How am I ever going to get back to the hotel? How can, you know, I'd be getting panic again. Two little Japanese girls came out, and they stood and sort of looked at me, you know. And so I started to ask them about St. Albans Church. And, of course, I yelled because that would make it easier for them to understand English. So finally, one of them nodded and understood and pointed over here. Well, here was a very modernistic building. It didn't look like a church at all. And there it was. Anyhow, I went in. It was a library on the first floor. And I asked the lady down there, I said, is there an AA meeting? And she said, upstairs. So I went upstairs. And here was a long hall with closed doors. And at the end of the hall was a John. So I looked at this door. It said third grade. I listened. I didn't hear anything. I went to the next door and said, second grade. I listened. I didn't hear anything. Went to the next door. It said, first grade. I put my ear to the door. Everything was quiet. The next door said, kindergarten. And I put my ear to the door. And I heard, rarely have we seen a person fail. I thoroughly followed our path. And I think that's an appropriate place for AA to be. In the kindergarten. Because that's where we're at, most of us, when we come into this fellowship. We're in the kindergarten of living. We're in the kindergarten of knowing how to live. And that's what AA teaches us. It teaches us how to live. And I began very slowly to grow away from that need to take a drink. I began to grow a little bit in my own life. I began to try and handle the problems that were in my life. Roger and I finally were divorced. I stayed married to him for 6 years after my sobriety, and he did not want what I had. The result was we were walking two separate paths, and the children were being affected by it because he was a daily drinker. And so he and I were separated. And it was at that point that AA really began to get active in my life, because he had resisted it so, and I had tried hard not to make it a predominant part of my life. He hadn't wanted me to bring AA people into our home. He used to say, I'm not going to have a lot of drunks in my house. So from then on, I began slowly to have AAs come to the house. I began to make more friends. And AA became a much closer part of my life. And I really, it was only at that time, and this was 6 years sober, so you can see how slow I was. So have hope, some of you who feel that perhaps it's not coming as fast as it should. And really, I think it was at that time that I finally began to be able to love me. Because then I was able to accept and receive what you were so freely giving. Up until then, I had had this wall around me. I had that fear of rejection. And finally, I was able to let that wall down and to love both me and you. And so my life in AA began to really grow at that time. And there was that sense of wonderful love in our household. My older daughter, who was then, 11 or 12, I don't know, came rushing home from school one day. And I'll never forget it, she rushed down this long hall. We lived in an old railroad apartment on Riverside Drive in New York. And I was working at the AA Intergroup office in New York as a secretary. And she came running down the hall one night as she came home from school. And she said, oh, Mommy, I know what I want to be when I grow up. I said, what, darling? Oh, she said, I want to be a ballet dancer and a member of AA. Of course, what she sensed was that wonderful love, that caring, that sense of belongingness that we somehow have with each other.
And I loved the fact that she felt that way. And so then I went on. I went on with my job, and then I went to General Service Office, where I had the most marvelous, thrilling experience in my life. To be a part of that heart of AA, to be there at that core, at that center, to know Bill, to have met Dr. Bob, to have known so many of those old timers, to see that spark that goes on there, without which I am deeply convinced AA would not have been able to grow around the world. There needed to be one central spot where information could be shared, where people from every land could write and say, will it work for us? And where literature and letters in their language could go out and say, yes, it will work for any alcoholic anywhere, as long as he is willing to follow a few simple suggestions. To be a part of that was one of the most exciting things in my life. And beyond that, to have an opportunity to take a leave of absence, to go and see AA around the world, because I got so hungry for it. I used to be on the overseas desk quite often at General Service, and to have these letters come in from faraway places, they say, I'm alone here. And then 6 months later, you get a letter saying, we're 40 in the group now. I think, God, they can't be, you know. And then to hear about a place down in El Salvador, where an American was married to an El Salvadorian, carried the message down there, and they wrote and said they had 10,000 members? You know, this kind of thing going on all over the world. And I thought, I've got to see, I've got to find out. Is it really doing that? And so I got a leave of absence. And right after the Toronto Convention in 65, I took off. And I went around the world. And I visited with AA everywhere. Well, not quite everywhere. I think I missed a couple of places. But I visited in South Africa and Australia and New Zealand, in Japan, where I just told you the story. In Singapore, all over Europe, I've sat in meetings in German, in Spanish, in Norwegian, in French. Sometimes I couldn't understand a word that was being said. And certainly I couldn't understand the Japanese. And I remember I went to a Japanese meeting at the Mission Anita Insane Asylum. A little off the beaten track for tourists, wouldn't you say? And they had this meeting, and all these little Japanese men were sitting around the table talking, and this man was going to translate for me. And I found that the translation interfered with my feeling, you know? Besides, I didn't need it. I'd look at them, and they'd start in. And you knew everything was hell, you know? And then they began starting, and you knew they were sober and happy. So, you know, who needed any translation? There used to be a member who should be nameless, a non-alcoholic on our board of trustees, who used to irritate me. I irritate easily. You know, one of the wonderful things about getting old is, in fact, you can say what you think. Anyway, he used to say, well, of course, AA is marvelous, but it only works for a certain kind of middle class, you know. I said, that's not true. Works for anybody. And I wish I could have brought him with me to the group in Singapore, where I sat with this marvelous bunch. Two Chinese, three Indians, one Thai, three Americans, an Indonesian, and two Australians. All middle-class bourgeois Americans, every one of them, right? No, wrong. This will work for anyone. And it was the most thrilling experience of my life to have that opportunity to see AA everywhere doing the same thing it does here. And they used to say to me, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest export the United States has ever made. And I believe it's true. And everywhere they'd say, are we doing it the way you do it? Are we doing it the right way? Is this the way you do it in the United States? And almost everywhere they were. Because they've learned that if they don't, then it doesn't work.
There have been some cases like in Norway where they tried to do it their way. The traditions are great for the United States, but things are different in Norway. We have a socialist form of government, therefore it's perfectly all right for the government to subsidize the alcoholic and treatment. Because otherwise they all stay drunk. So they learn. And so the traditions need to be followed. AA does need to be followed along the lines of what has worked. Because that's the wonderful thing about this marvelous program. It's based on what works. It isn't some magic that somebody way up there decided they'd write out and say, this should be good for alcoholics. No. This is what they said. This is how we stayed sober those first 100. This is the way it works. And Bill wrote down those steps as a result of that early experience. And the rest of them helped him rewrite it. And the traditions came out of our group experience when things began to go wrong. So the traditions were based on our own experience. Everything in AA is based on our own experience. And we have learned through this beautiful program to have the opportunity to grow one day at a time. To learn that life is for living and for loving. You know, when I was drinking, it was a way of death. It was a self-destructiveness that I didn't recognize. Life is sweet now. Life is wonderful. Life is joyous. That doesn't mean there aren't days that are rotten. It doesn't mean that sorrow and sadness and despair. It doesn't mean that problems and unhappiness can't come into my life. That beautiful little girl who said she wanted to be a ballet dancer and a member of AA was a great source of unhappiness and despair for some time until her dream came true, and 2.5 years ago she got sober in AA. So it isn't that life is always beautiful. It's the fact that it is an excitement, that we can accept the challenge, that we can live with it, and that we learn, above all, to love it. Because that's really what life is all about. And that's what I found in AA. That's why I love it. That's why you love it, Clancy. But you know, as Mike said last night, his sponsor's gone. My sponsor's gone. Bill is gone. Many of the old-timers have gone. And a sense of mortality sometimes is apt to overwhelm us, particularly when your own son is approaching 50 and you begin to wonder, you know, about yourself. And I came across this little poem, and I'd like to read it to you. Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not there. I do not sleep. I am 1,000 winds that blow. I am the diamond glint on snow. I am the sunlight on ripened grain. I am the gentle autumn rain. When you awake in the morning's hush, I am the swift upswimming rush of quiet birds in circling flight. I am the soft starshine at night. Do not stand at my grave and cry. I am not there. I did not die. And I like to think of that as I think of those that have gone before. They did not die. They're here. They were on that wave of love that greeted me when I came in last night. And God is love.